Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight I'm one-on-one with Dr. Victoria Sweet. For 20 years, Dr. Sweet was a physician at San Francisco's long-term care facility, Laguna Honda, one of the last almshouses in America. In 2012, she wrote a book about her experience there called God's Hotel, which is now out in paperback. In her book, Dr. Sweet makes the case for an approach to long-term care that is out of fashion today, with our current focus on efficiency, technology, and patient privacy. Her call for slow medicine and for a reintroduction of some aspects of institutionalized care has struck a chord among doctors, nurses, and patients, and interest in slow medicine has grown into something more like a movement. Dr. Sweet is currently an associate clinical professor at the University of California, San Francisco, and she's also a Guggenheim Fellow and is writing her latest book, Slow Medicine, Healing in the Age of Technology. Welcome to the program, Victoria Sweet.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've often listened to City Visions on my drive home.
That's great. And so you may have heard, and this is that we're spending our holidays moving into some temporary studios, preparing for a renovation of our primary facility that will be taking place in the first half of 2016. So we're still sort of getting used to our new digs. So tonight we won't actually be able to take your calls, but we're still going to try to take other ways of sharing your interests and questions with us. So you can still text or email us tonight at cityvisions@klw.org. You can still tweet us at cityvisionsklw, or you can post a comment at the KLW website. So that's to our listeners to let you know kind of how tonight's show is gonna unfold. So can I call you Victoria?
Of course. Thank
Victoria, I'd like you to read from your book. We talked about this before the show started, what you'd pick. You picked something that I think captures the experience of someone who came to the United States from abroad and experienced something she never thought she could experience. Why don't you set it up for us and then read that for us?
Yes. So this is a patient who is very dear to me. I call her Rodka in the book. She was from Bulgaria, and I gradually got to know her. One of the really interesting things about Laguna Honda was that you gradually got to know people, because people would come in for 6 weeks, 2 months, a year. And so you didn't just have one meeting, or you just didn't have little bits. You got to know people over time. Rodka was a fascinating woman. She had a PhD from Bulgaria. I never was quite sure how she ended up or why, but it was clear she was some kind of illegal refugee. And she ended up at Laguna Honda because she ended up with metastatic cervical cancer. She's from Bulgaria, and she was treated wonderfully at San Francisco General, and then came to Laguna Honda because she was too weak from the metastatic cancer and the chemotherapy to have her usual job as an economist cleaning houses under the table. She had a beautiful daughter who looked just like her, except with hair, who was from Bulgaria and visited and was a journalist. And there was one point at which, you know, the old Laguna Honda was in these open wards with those old-fashioned long Florence Nightingale wards, and Rodka was in a little corner of the ward, but she was getting woken up a lot, and I really wanted to see. There were a couple of private rooms. So eventually a private room came up for her, and I tried to persuade her to take it. And she didn't want it exactly, and I was trying to understand why. And finally, after a couple of these readmissions, actually, she went back and forth, and the bed came up, and it went away. And finally, I said, you know, you really should take it, Rodka. And there was some worry she wasn't telling. Then I understood. You know, I explained, this is a public hospital. It's run by the city for the poor. In my mind, I call it God's Hotel, because that's what we used to call hospitals for the poor, and what they're still called in France. Rodka nodded. It's old-fashioned. It's funky. It's not fancy, but it's free. You mean, doctor, that the private room doesn't cost any more than this bed? No, I told her. It's all the same. Laguna Honda Hospital is a hospital for those who have nothing. We have some private rooms, some double rooms, lots of ward rooms, but all the beds cost the same. Nothing. Rodka got even quieter than usual. America, she said. America is a wonderful country. And by that, she meant a generous country, a rich country of generosity in the true sense of the word generosus, noble. America, especially these days, in its role as everyone's younger sibling, focuses on its faults. Like the Puritans, its stone-faced founders, America is sternly self-unforgiving. We see only what we do not do, have not accomplished, have done badly or even wrongly. And seen from the perfect eyes of the perfect God, this vision of ourselves may be just and accurate. But seen from Rodka's eyes, America is almost unbelievable. Hunted by her own country for some right or wrong that she did, stoically with tight lips and quiet mind, cleaning houses, with little hope of ever going home. Why should America take account of her? And yet it does, freely and with goodwill. America keeps Rodka warm in the winter and cool in the summer, gives her food, treats her cancer, and surrounds her with kindness, if not luxury, and asks for nothing back, not even gratitude. America is a wonderful country. We should be proud.
So I'm curious why you picked that piece, because as I read your book, you struggled with how America was changing and the American medicine was changing.
Mm-hmm.
So how is it that this one snippet was what you chose to open the show with?
Well, I only got one snippet.
That's true.
So I had to choose the real nail for the job, so to speak. And it's because in a way, I think one of the problems we're having in healthcare, there's two ways of looking at it, right? One is the whole commodification of healthcare. And I make a distinction between healthcare and medical care. This whole concept of healthcare as a commodity that comes out of healthcare economists and looking at the big picture has what's created this, you know, doctor as provider and patient as consumer with everything that goes along with it, which is the opposite of what I'm talking about here and the opposite of the piece I just read. Medical care, doctors as doctors and patients and this whole vulnerability that patients have is sort of on the other side. And one of the reasons that we're in the problem we have is you can't take this model of healthcare as a commodity and take these deep felt values of America, really. And when you put them together, you get a mess. Why? Because you really can't have a system where everybody is both treated equally and well. In a commodified system. And so when they clash, I think you get the sense that America's medical care is in crisis and we need to fix it, and then all of our fixes end up being more and more complicated, making a mess out of things. So I picked this because I think it brings us down to the bottom line is Laguna Honda was funky. It wasn't as fancy as all the other hospitals in the city, but what it did was take care of the sick poor well. And the fact that it wasn't equal is not relevant. And the fact, right? So that's, I think, what I think we need to kind of come back to. Is that...
That what?
Does that kind of work for you?
I guess it does. I'm curious how, you know, what is the essence of that? You said a lot in those words, but what is the essence of that? And how do we get back to it, and what is going to get us back there, if indeed it is something that as a society we commit to or have as a call, if there's a call for this. A lot of your book describes kind of how what you were able to do at Laguna Honda, a lot of you couldn't do at other places, which is have the luxury of time.
That's right.
Have the luxury of getting to know people over various days, weeks, months, years, as you describe. And that just isn't the way that people experience healthcare these days. So tell us more about what was so...
Well, I guess because... So there's a number of streams here. So I'm going to try and undo them a little bit in my own head. So I feel very, very strongly that medicine is not a commodity. That this idea that patients are consumers and they're going to be gaily looking up on the internet and figuring out which, you know, injection to give themselves is not just ridiculous, but really harmful. That it's a personal relationship between a doctor and a patient, and the patient is vulnerable. When you're sick, you are just vulnerable, and you have to trust that you have a doctor, not a healthcare provider, who's got your best interest at heart. And so where I see us going, the time thing, people's discontent with it has to do with time, but it also has to do with what's happened in the last 30 years. So one of the things I did in this book is wind in these stories of patients. So the patients are teaching me in this book one whole thing, which is this whole vulnerability, the whole importance of what we do. And then there's another thing that's happening, was this political pull in the opposite direction, which in the – and what's confusing about it is the marketing words sound great for the healthcare as commodity thing, right? But in reality, it's horrible. Hmm. And so time is a byproduct of what the fact that time's dropped out of medicine, which is the essence of the matter, is a byproduct of this healthcare as commodity piece. It was a political, it's been a whole thing that's happened. And as time has gone away from the system, that's the essence of the matter. That's time is what allows doctors and patients to connect, allows me as a doc to figure out what's wrong with a patient. So not only this, you know, lovely personal relationship, but in order, I think when a good doctor has enough time with patient, we're likely to get the right diagnosis and the right treatment. And so it's not just that we want a touchy-feely relationship with our doc. It's that for me to do a good job, I need to have enough time to talk to you, examine you, re-examine you, talk to your other docs, collect things, try things, go back. And that's what I had at Laguna Honda. So Laguna Honda, on the one hand, was funky. If you ever was at the old, it was old-fashioned, but it had that time there. And because it had the time, it had those that personal relationship, not just with the docs, with the nurses, with the social workers, with our live-in nun and our live-in priest and all the crazy things that we had there. And because we had the time, we could have the personal relationship. We could have the personal relationship. We could also have the right diagnosis and the right treatment. I had many patients who would take me, and not just me, right, months to really understand what was really going on with them. You contrast that to where we've gone with this model of healthcare as commodity, which came in the 80s because we were spending more and more on healthcare, and healthcare as an economic thing. What piece of our economy do we spend on healthcare? Well, we spend X amount, and that's bad. Whatever it was bad. So when they first started, it was 12%. That was bad. Now, they more and more they've worked on this concept. It's now up to 17.6%. So we are actually spending more and more, the more it turns into healthcare as a commodified piece. And what's dropped out of that is the time that doctors used to have with patients. Hmm. And if we can get the time back, then I think we can reverse things. And so that's a lot of what I'm talking about with slow medicine is it's not just the time, but time's a good thing to talk about. And one of the things I'd like to do is one of the things I learned at Laguna Honda, which was very impressive to me, is that when I had enough time, I could get the right diagnosis. And when I didn't have enough time, we had to send everybody off for labs and x-rays, very expensive. So the economists have based their model on the idea that doctors are very expensive. And anything we can do to replace doctor time will save money. And I believe that that's wrong. And that and I'm willing to have an experiment. I think we should have some experiments and say, okay, that's what you guys think. Well, here's what I think. I think if you give doctors as much time as they need with patients, you will get the right diagnosis and the right treatment and save money. So let's have an experiment, right? Let's have a clinic. I think of it as a slow medicine clinic, where as an experiment, really, we just put a sign up, slow medicine clinic. We put two docs in it, the sign up, come, and you just leave the docs alone. Take as much time as you want with the patient. Have the patient back, don't have the patient back, whatever. And at the end of the year or 2 years, see how that group of patients compares financially, economically, to the group of patients in an ordinary clinic in terms of very verifiable things, not their happiness with their care, but how many ER visits have they had? How many hospitalizations? How many medications are they on? How many lab tests? How much did it cost? And I'm pretty sure that it will cost considerably less to do that model than it would our usual model.
So I was, as you were describing this, I was thinking about what has sprung up recently, sort of this boutique medicine or concierge medicine. You know, you've I could name a few of those in the city here. How does what you're describing compare to those models?
Perfect question. Thank you very much. So while I've been working all this out, thinking about it for quite a few years now, this model came up, which is, I think the essence of the model is that it actually started about 15 years ago now. It's concierge medicine. Sometimes it's called boutique medicine. Sometimes it's called direct pay. But what it really is there were doctors who said, you know what? I can't take care of 2,500 patients, which is what healthcare economists have decided primary care docs should have, which is crazy. So these docs said, you know what? I can take care of like 300 patients really well. I can visit them in their homes. I can see them as much as I want. I can see them in the hospital. I can see them in the ER. I can do a really good job. So they ended up saying to their patients, I'm going to only take 300 patients. And they took the sum total of their practice and divided it into 300. And they got about $5,000 or $6,000 now a year. And you have a concierge doctor. And the concierge doctor has you. So usually between 100 and 300 patients. And the docs do exactly what I'm talking about. They have enough time with patients. And it's gone on long enough that studies are coming out now. And here's the answer. The answer is that if you follow those patients, they have, it's amazing, they have 15% fewer hospitalizations and 40% fewer ER visits. Now, that's absolutely enormous. You know, one non-ER visit pays, in terms of the health, what the system spends, pays for the whole doc for the whole year. So, and there's other studies being done. So that's really interesting. But the problem is that, well, they're rich people. So, and we know rich people do better than poor people. So I want to see what happens if you have a concierge practice for the sick poor. So that's my second thought. So you have a slow medicine clinic is one way, and then have a concierge practice for the sick poor where you take the most difficult patients that you take care of and I take care of. And you basically give them a concierge doctor and you follow them for 2 years as a proof of principle, right? Will they end up on fewer medicines with fewer tests, fewer ER visits, and fewer hospitalizations? You know they will. But we need the study.
So you've been talking about this for a while since this book originally came out in 2012. Mm-hmm. What has been the response? I imagine there was a lot of response to the somewhat tell-all version of the of the book that is about Laguna Honda.
Well, tell most, actually.
Tell most, but not tell all. But then there's the other part, which is the call to the for slow medicine, which my understanding is it is a concept that has taken root and around the world in various places. What has been the response to your call for this? And has anyone taken you up on this offer to do an experiment?
I've had quite a few, I don't know what to call it. I don't call it actually bites, but, you know, there's a lot of interest out there. I have had to like reorganize my mind because I'm not exactly a kind of person who thinks like in terms of an organization or grants or a this sort of thing. So it's taken me a while, but we've got a group now, a working group out of Berkeley and UCSF that we're calling to put together an institute for slow medicine, hopefully out of UCSF, where we would in fact put together a slow medicine clinic and concierge practice for the sick poor. And I have a number of other ideas as well, because this whole concept of slow medicine about taking enough time with the patients, really doing a good physical, really figuring them out. You know, it's a time, you know how medicine is. One generation of medical students is like dog years, right? It's like 4 years, it's the second generation. So I think we need almost a slow medicine fellowship. We need a slow medicine rotation. So this Institute for Slow Medicine would want to put that together and be able to not just have these things, but do healthcare economic studies on the cost effectiveness. Because it's the cost effectiveness that's interesting to me.
So another area that I wanted to ask you about is to keep on the economics theme here for a second, the basic sort of supply and demand issue, right? One of the biggest hopes, and it's panning out in most parts of the country, is that with the expansion, with the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, that there has been expansion of access to healthcare, right? And especially in the states that have decided to expand Medicaid, there has been an expansion of access for the sick poor. And so the demand is growing. On the commercial side, there's lots of concerns that people can't, may are getting care, but the networks of providers they have access to are so narrow that mm-hmm. they can't actually get access to that care. Mm-hmm. So as our country is trying in its latest iteration to increase access to care, the demand increases, and we have at the same time sort of flat or less and less people wanting to go into primary care, which would be the first stop for mm-hmm, people who right, wanted to engage right. in slow medicine. There's going to be the supply-demand mismatch, right? How are people going to be able to slow down when there's the demand is outstripping the supply?
It's really a complicated question because it's like got six different elements of it, at least, that occur. I mean, for one thing is my whole generation of docs are all retiring. And it's not because we want to retire. We can't stand what's going on there from our own sake, you know, to be an experienced physician and be given, you know, have like 3 minutes with your patient is so frustrating. So there's a whole generation of docs who should not be going out of the system if that's what you're talking about. I mean, if you're talking about when you say demand, you know, the demand for docs or the supply of docs, if that's what you're talking about, one piece is everybody I know is dropping out of medicine as soon as they can. And I believe that if we had satisfying experiences for docs, and what I mean by that is they have enough time to do a good job, you'd get a lot of those docs back, and they're actually wonderful because people my age, we do the least. We've seen so much, we don't do very much, right? We don't do everything in the same way. From a practical sense, at the same time, there is actually flood of physicians. You know, there's all these new medical schools. There's at least, I think, 30 medical schools that are going to be pouring out physicians in about 2019. If you're looking at actual numbers. But I also think from a philosophical point of view, it's like if you do it right the first time, you don't have to keep doing it over and over again. So from a practical point of view, if I take care of a patient and I actually figure out what's wrong with them, that not just money, it's the time-wise, it's like so much more efficient from a time perspective because I'm not sitting there sending them to consultants all over the place. I'm just taking care of it here and now. I may spend more of my time doing that for the first month or two, but once they're tucked in, you can move on. So I think from what I've seen, there is so much wastage, not to speak of the electronic medical records, which is we were trying to find a way to shoot about 70% of our docs. We would have come up with an electronic health records. And what I mean by that is the last study by Christine Zinsky from about 3 years ago showed that she followed docs around a bunch of primary care practices and saw how much time they spent on their computers. 70%, okay, on electronic medical records as opposed to 15%. So we just lost 55% of our docs because electronic medical records are so bad. Now, it's not been published, but I heard through the grapevine that Kaiser was interested in how much time their doctors spent on electronic health records, okay? I mean, if we're talking here, time is the essence of what the doctor does. So they kept track for several months of a bunch of different doctors in a bunch of different hospitals, and I don't know the details. I just got kind of told this by the back door about how much time the docs spent on the computer, right? Because the docs were all whining about they don't have any time with patients. And the answer was when they added up all the time and divided by the number of doctors that out of an 8-hour day that the docs were spending 10 hours on the computer. So we don't have any docs. We take care of our computers. We don't take care of our patients. Mm. So another idea I've had is to have a slow medicine day. It'd be kind of like a strike day, only what we would be striking was the computer. So on slow medicine day, we wouldn't take care of our computers. We would take care of our patients that one day.
So what I'm hearing you talk about is that the way things are set up, both from a technological standpoint and the economic model, and the erosion of time, that everything now is laid out in a way that is counterproductive to what you think is a good doctor-patient relationship.
Yeah, that's right.
So, how do you unwind this?
Well, I'm kind of a minimalist, you know, and I think there's a couple of things I would say because I've also thought about this a lot. So there's, I can say this in different ways. So one thing I thought a lot about was slow administration. One of the things that made Laguna Honda at the time I was there work so well is that the administration, without knowing it, was practicing slow administration in the same way you practice slow medicine, right? I.e., you don't just rush in, you know, you don't rush in and do something. You do a lot of nothing. You do as much nothing as possible. You don't answer every question. You don't try and fix everything. You just kind of sit back and watch things for a while. Watch what's really the problem before you try and fix it. And a lot of the problems we have are about this need to, like, fix everything and have everything wonderful and everybody rushing around with their projects. I'd say the second thing I've thought about is when I look at a mess of a system like this, I think about a patient. Suppose I think about our healthcare system as if it were a Laguna Honda patient. Chronically ill, lots of problems, lots of things, lots of medications. What would I do? Well, the first thing I would do is I would really look at him for a while, and then I would pick the thing that was most important to do first. And then I would do the next thing and the next thing and the next thing in order. And I would also recognize that, you know, the patient wasn't dead. So whatever's going along, I did have some time. So I think this urgency to fix everything all at once is a problem. But if I got to do one thing, I think that having some pilot studies, because if you just talk about changing, wave your hands around, the healthcare economists can come back and say, oh, that's too expensive. So it seems to me, why not hit that nail and say, we're doing a pilot project. It's not expensive. It's cheaper. You save money. You have to allocate your resources differently.
And why do you think that saving money isn't as sexy as making money?
Oh, really? Well, because when you save money, you don't actually save the money. You save the money for someone else. But when you make the money, you make it for yourself. So if I come up with some new great system, a computer system or some special thing, and I get venture capitalists and I build a da-da-da-da, I'm making money. What do I care whether it's taking 1% out of the healthcare budget?
So I want to reintroduce the program. In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight I'm talking with Dr. Victoria Sweet, author of God's Hotel and associate clinical professor at UCSF. She worked at Laguna Honda for more than 20 years. And we're talking mostly tonight about the concept of slow medicine and how in her mind and in her experience at Laguna Honda, we need to go back to a time when we can increase the amount of time between patients and doctors to be able to get it right. It's time to invite you to join us with your questions and comments. As I mentioned at the top of the hour, we're in the midst of our move into our temporary digs here, and so we don't have our phone lines available this evening, but we are welcoming you to text or email us, cityvisions@klw.org, tweet us at cityvisionsklw, or post a comment at the KALW website. Do you have an experience with slow medicine or experience with Laguna Honda that you'd like to share with us? Let us know. So we've talked about the argument for slow medicine. I wanted to talk about sort of what got you there besides your experience with Laguna Honda. What are some other influences? Specifically, talk about your I would call it your love affair with Hildegard of Bingen. Yes. And her work in pre-modern, what you call pre-modern medicine. Tell us how that influenced and dovetailed with this revolutionary idea.
That is how I got to Laguna Honda, actually, because I'd practiced for quite a few years as an internist before I got to Laguna Honda. And usually I ended up in little clinics or in the middle of no place because I just like that kind of practice. And over the years, I was struck by how effective modern medicine is and how wonderful it was, but I was also struck more and more by what it left out. There was just this clear this something. So I began looking into alternative medicines at the time, and homeopathy and naturopathy and Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine, which I found very interesting systems that seemed to put something that we're missing back. But they were all too foreign and too kind of didn't have enough substance. And then I discovered just by accident in the library a book that really changed my life, and it had been newly translated. It was called Hildegard of Bingen's Medicine. So it turned out Hildegard was a 12th century nun in Germany, and she'd written this book on medical practice, so pre-modern medicine, and it had just been translated into English. And I found it by accident in the library, and I started to read it, and I was going like, wow, this is so interesting. Because it resembled a lot in its feeling tone of alternative medicine and naturopathy and kind of what was left out, but it was from the West. So I decided at that point that I was going to kind of understand this system. So we used to have a completely different system of understanding the body in the West. We didn't always have our essentially body as machine, doctor as mechanic model. So I wanted to go back and get a PhD, and I wanted Hildegard to be my model, to be my focus of my PhD. And for that, I needed to practice medicine half-time, and that's how I got to Laguna Honda, because at the time, it was the only place that let me practice medicine half-time. So I spent most of the time at Laguna Honda working also half-time on my PhD, and Hildegard was fascinating. Because I gradually understood that her model of the body was a very different model from ours. Her model of the body was body as plant, and doctor is gardener, as opposed to our model of body is machine. Well, what's really the difference between those two things? Well, the difference is that someone has to fix a broken machine. But a plant can heal itself. And Hildegard, it turned out, has a name for the quality of a plant to heal itself, and she called it viriditas. And that's from the Latin viridis, which means green, like French vert and Spanish verde. And so it's greenness. And when she watched a plant, because I think she was also a gardener had an infirmary garden in the monastery. But she watched a plant grow and produce this sort of thing it was doing. She called viriditas, and she believed that human beings also had viriditas, and that the job of the doc was not to do something, but to remove what was in the way of this natural healing power of your patient. So these were two very, very different models. And what I found at Laguna Honda, because I had so much time with patients, is I would get a patient and I would start by practicing the model I'd learned, modern medicine, body as machine, what's wrong with the patient. But then as they started to heal and do rehab and things, I began to look at my patients with this different eye, with Hildegard's eye, and ask myself, not what's wrong with the patient, how can I fix it, but what's in the way of their natural healing power and what can I do to remove it? What's in the way, and support that natural healing power.
So what's interesting to me about you describing this is that this, in some ways, could also be called, you know, patient-centered care, which is one of those buzzwords that we hear a lot about. What is different about the patient-focused care that you describe and what you see happening in American medicine today in terms of this notion of, patient as consumer, patient as customer. How are those two things different, and how do they compare?
Makes me want to crawl under the table. Really, it's they couldn't really be more different. I mean, I guess what I would say, I thought a lot about it. I think we were talking before, and I got invited actually to Budapest because the book got translated into Hungarian, and I was asked to debate a medical futurist who was also an MD PhD, and he believed, and it was a really interesting debate, that course you kind of just describe is the right course for us to take. His model is to have patients with sensors, and they're uploading their data, and they're going, and there's big algorithms they can follow, and that, you know, they will take care of themselves in that sense, and that doctors could be essentially robots. So I've thought a lot about that concept. Yeah. At best, technicians, because once you get to the technician, then why can't you have a computer do all of it? So I had fun actually thinking about, well, what would be wrong with that? Skip fast forward and make it all perfect. So suppose you had a computer in your computer that was like, I thought of it as Dr. Kildare. I don't know if you remember Dr. Kildare. He was like, you know, the handsome doc from the 60s. But a computer program who had that face, who was a perfect mesh, and you could just go on and talk to the computer and tell him what was wrong with you. You had all the time in the world, available 24/7, and then Amazon would deliver by drone your medications, and sort of what was wrong with that model. And I've been thinking a lot about that, sort of Dr. Robot versus Dr. Personal, which is where the Dr. Robot piece is where you get. If you follow this string of patient is consumer, healthcare is commodity, you end up with this sort of model of robot. And it's because it's practicing medicine without a soul. So the difference between a robot and a person is that the person has a soul. And what I mean by that is you just need to look at the actual patient. It's heretical, but you actually have to look at the patient. You have to be in the same room as the patient and see them and smell them and feel them and connect and interact. That's medicine.
So tell us more about what you learned from Hildegard about this tending to people.
Well, it was really interesting because it's a very interesting way to think about a problem, which is instead of how can we do something to the problem, how can we remove what's in the way of the problem? And so with a patient at Laguna Honda, for instance, once they got to the stage of, like, I knew what was wrong with them, and then I'd look at them and go, like, okay, so how would Hildegard look at this patient? If I was looking at this patient as a plant that was ailing, let's say, I thought, you know, Hildegard would remove what was in the way of viriditas. For instance, uncomfortable bed clothes or hopelessness or food they didn't like, that kind of stuff, any medications they didn't need. You know, the average Laguna Honda patient would come in from the general on between 15 and 25 medications. And every one of those medications is interfering with whatever we want to call it, but takes time to get them off that, right? So that's what she would do. She would remove all those things, and then she would support, I thought, this is what I tried to do, her patients with the basics, you know, good food, fresh air, deep sleep, and quiet, right? And so that was kind of the way I saw it. You'd kind of remove what was in the way, and then you support it. And it was amazing to see how patients would get better. It was a pleasure.
So that their environment really mattered.
Huge. It was like putting them back inside their environment as opposed to just seeing them as this thing. Exactly. And changing the environment around them.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, are you spiritual? Do you have a religious tradition?
I like all religions. So I would say I wouldn't use the word spiritual, but I really like religions. I'll do anything.
So much about how you write in this book that there's a
yes, I do.
Sort of you also talk about a pilgrimage that
yes,
you took.
Yes.
So I'm curious, just on a personal level, sort of what is about medicine and your call to medicine. Where which part of you or parts of you did this speak to?
That's always hard when I'm asked that, because you bring me to that place. But then it's hard to talk about it. It's sort of like it's really what matters. I mean, life is incredible. Life is unbelievable. We get to be alive. We get to experience this moment. I think it is holy. Just living, just right this instant, breathing, the whole thing. And when you're with the patient, I think it's double, at least double. So you can really... because you're dealing with the most important things. That's the bottom line. And that's what I find so infuriating about this healthcare is commodity thing. Is like, this is nothing. This is just crazy. You know, healthcare like it's a vending machine. You are a consumer. You put in, you get a box of healthcare out.
Let me go ahead and put the ways that our listeners can join our conversation out there again. This is City Visions on 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. We're talking with Dr. Victoria Sweet, advocate for slow medicine. We are not taking calls this evening, but we can hear from you via text or email, cityvisions@klw.org. It's a little ironic that we can't hear people's voices tonight on a night where
because I'm thinking
it's all about technology.
That's right. So we're excluding anybody who can't do that little thing, which would probably be me.
You could also tweet us at cityvisionsklw, post a comment at our website. So let's see here. We had a couple of tweets, in fact. There you go. This is from Venkat. And Venkat says, can you talk more about how slow medicine's impact beyond primary care? Do you see slow medicine when it comes to specialty care? And what I would add there, and I imagine what Venkat is describing, is that, you know, specialty care is all about the technology and about, you know, the latest and greatest type of treatments. So how do you see slow medicine interacting with the specialty world?
That's a really interesting question to think about, and I haven't thought about it too much. So here's what comes up for me. Since specialists are also physicians, my experience of the best specialists is that they are not just technicians, that the really good ones are fundamentally doctors first and their eye doctors second. And so I imagine for them, I don't think it would actually be a revolutionary change for them, because the other thing I've been struck by is that specialists actually still have more time with patients than primary care people. I went with a friend to her cardiologist, and I was so amazed. The cardiologist had 45 minutes with her. It was fascinating. So they had a real interaction. I mean, they had plenty of time. I don't know if that's an example, but that's kind of what I'm thinking about that.
Yeah, because the primary care model, even as it's changing, is really about the FaceTime, although that, as you describe, is eroding. But there's the specialists, they get to do procedures, right? So to me, it'll be interesting to see how this concept would, you know, would it mean there's less procedures to be done?
I'm sure there would be fewer procedures, but there would be fewer procedures because, you know, to the extent that we want to fix everything all the time, and if we just give Veriditas a chance, we know already with things like back pain, and we can do a whole litany of what happens with back pain and not doing things and how many CT scans, MRIs, et cetera, not even to speak of the surgical procedures you change by giving people enough time to heal when they have back pain. So I'm sure you would have fewer procedures, but I'm not sure that would be so bad from the specialist point of view. Probably they would think it was bad, I bet.
They would think it was bad.
They might not like that.
Less procedures?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
We'd have to see.
Yeah.
So that makes me think about, as a primary care provider, sometimes patients come to you with wanting the procedure or wanting the MRI. Yeah. How much of the convincing here, of the argument, do you need to make to patients instead of or in addition to making it to healthcare economists, administrators, politicians? How do you engage patients in thinking that less is more, or time is more valuable than a procedure, a prescription, they've been kind of conditioned to this type of life, and not only in their healthcare interactions, but I imagine in other spheres of their
life.
That's right.
Because it's the interesting thing is that I started calling it slow medicine just because of slow food, right? Mm-hmm. Same thing. Are we going to eat less if you do slow food? Yeah, probably. People have been conditioned, absolutely, and I can't imagine what it would be like these days to be sitting in a clinic with everybody having read the latest, you know, advertisement and go see your doctor and get a this, that, and the other thing, and how much. I think that would be very difficult. If you have enough time, if the patient feels like you actually are trying to figure out what's wrong with them, then I think there's a lot less push to do things. But you always are going to have a group of patients who want X and they demand X, and I just cut to the chase and give them X.
So I've heard you talk about your book before, and I'm curious, and what you haven't said so far tonight, and I'm curious if it's because you're thinking differently or just because it hasn't come up. You're not saying that what I guess the opposite of slow medicine is fast medicine.
Yeah, right.
That there's something wrong with fast medicine, that it needs to be discarded to the point that it needs to be discarded. You're talking about making room for slow medicine.
Yeah.
Describe that. How would we balance this? How would we know when we need to be fast and when we need to slow down?
Well, for one thing, you know, the only problem with the word slow medicine is it does focus on time and slowing down, and that is actually not its essence. And going back to the whole slow food movement, so when I was thinking about this at some point, I asked myself, you know, if it's like slow medicine, if slow medicine is like slow food, it's more of a style. It's really more of a style than it is a time thing. And so I asked myself, can you have slow fast food? And can you have fast slow food? And you can. And in fact, I went and read, you know, the guy who, Petrini, I think his name is, who came up with the whole concept of slow food in the 70s. And I read his book because, and he touches on, you can have slow fast food. Right? Slow fast food in his neighborhood, right? You can imagine that they put the kind of style into it. They care about their ingredients, but they're selling it on the street. But it's traditional recipes that they sell as slow fast food. And you can also have fast slow food, which is what we see now, right? Because these, you know, I don't know what brand I could talk about on the air, but there's these, you know, restaurants who they've picked up the arugula of this, but it's in a fast food manner. It's industrial, it's commodified, it's, you know, well, Atul Gawande's thing on Cheesecake Factory, perfect example of what I would call, you know, fast slow food. So to me, it's a style. And the style of fast isn't so much fast, it's I've got it all sort of mushed together here, but it's, so if I get called, if somebody collapses, and I get called, there's a code or something, and you run over there, I'm in fast mode. It's not that I run over there that's a fast. It's the way I'm analyzing that. I'm looking what's wrong, right? What's wrong and how can I fix it? It's like that. And then the slow model is much more kind of unfocused, and it's much more about process. And I think of them as two tools in my black bag. And sometimes the right tool is fast medicine and sometimes the right tool is slow medicine, and usually it's both applied to the right person at the right time.
How does this you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but I want to go back there and unpack it a little bit. How does this slow medicine concept dovetail with integrative medicine? So places mm-hmm. that are bringing in other mm-hmm, traditions, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it be traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, mindfulness, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. acupuncture, those types of things. How mm-hmm. does what you describe relate to that, and how is it different?
Well, that's a great question. So on the one hand, a lot of what you just mentioned are out of a tradition that, if we don't call it slow medicine now, but we call it sort of the whole effective environment on people and a kind of way of removing what's wrong. I've had a lot of emails and letters from people who are acupuncturists or Chinese docs going like, this is what we're taught. I didn't know this, but they actually taught that the body's a plant and a lot of this and qi flows and there's obstructions. So this is a very... And one of the reasons I think it touches things is that because we had this tradition in the West, and then in the 19th century when everything got replaced with machines, our model of the body got replaced as a machine model. And so we actually have this in our vocabulary. So that way is very similar. It's very similar.
And so it can – and is there a traditional – Western medicine that you could practice that without having to go there necessarily and draw from those other traditions?
Absolutely. You could actually. In fact, there's a whole, I haven't been there, but I want to go. is there's like a whole Hildegard of Bingen medical movement with this Hildegard spa, and they I mean, I don't, you know, with her herbs. And so in Europe, actually, there is that kind of tradition. And don't forget, it never really disappeared. So our tradition didn't disappear, but it got pushed underground in the 19th century. It got pushed down because this whole new thing, we had microscopes and thermometers, and then we had EKGs. And so it got pushed into the naturopathy. Homeopathy is the homeopathy, if you go back and look at it, that whole style of homeopathy is directly, in fact, really fascinating. The guy who did homeopathy was reading Paracelsus. And Paracelsus actually went to Bingen and read Hildegard's book in Bingen as he was practicing. So there's actually a continuous tradition that we still have that taps into this. But to be able to have our wonderful modern medicine, but to practice it in a different style, is what I think would be optimal, to know when to take out the fast medicine, to know when to jump on somebody and do it, and to know when to create space around you, I think is the trick. Hmm.
So I wanted to shift gears a little bit, because another part of your book really talks about your concerns about how the deinstitutionalization of our systems of care have led to unintended consequences. And I'm curious how you see the slow medicine piece connecting to that, if at all. Mm-hmm. And so tell us a little bit more about what your take is on places like Laguna Honda. You know, if we think it's one of the last almshouses in the country. How has our care changed, and how have people not benefited from that? Right. Because there's been a movement to get people out of institutional care and independent community-based living, which on its surface mm-hmm. sounds pretty good, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, the whole deinstitutionalization movement had sort of two pieces, right? There's the state mental hospitals. There's that whole thing that happened. And then there was the almshouses. So we used to have a system that grew out of the Middle Ages where we had a big old county hospital that San Francisco still has for the acutely ill. And then we had a almshouse, rehab facility, whatever you want to call it, on the outskirts of the city that was an almshouse, that when you didn't know what else to do with somebody, they could always go to the almshouse. So it was really, that system was a wonderful system because it was the safety net of the safety nets, and it was sacrosanct. I mean, it lasted, goes all the way back to the Middle Ages, and it never came apart. It was funky. It wasn't fair. The rich people had this care and the poor people, but they had something. So what I regret most of all is the loss of this. We have it in this city. So when I go around the country and I'm talking, and even now in Europe they're taking it apart, people are like, really? You have that? I mean, it's a very cool thing that if you're a citizen of San Francisco and you know if the worst comes to worst and you don't have insurance, you don't have any money, and you just are, you can go to the county hospital and you will be taken care of, and that you won't be thrown out on the streets with your broken leg. And that seems to me to be like the basis. So to not have that system is a pity. And I think accepting that it's, you know, it was this battle between the left and the right, and the left didn't like that system because it wasn't equal, and the right didn't like it because it was expensive. And so there was this nice little collusion where they both agreed to, like, for various reasons, have those places fall apart. So you go to another city, people have no place to go. They show up at the private hospital, and then the private hospital has to admit them and do the least it can do because they lose money every time, and then get them out of there as quickly as possible. So from a practical point of view, having that old-fashioned system is useful. The deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill is a whole different issue, and that's finally coming. People are starting to turn around and realize that we lost something really valuable for the really acutely, chronically, severely mentally ill, and we lost those state hospitals, which is not to say they were wonderful, but they existed. And I think going back to Rodka, that, you know, the perfect is the enemy of the good. And I think that's what's happened with our institutions, is because we see everything that's wrong with them. We're going to replace them with all this wonderful stuff, and ideas are great, and then a budget crunch comes, and everything disappears, and you've got homeless wandering the streets who are psychiatrically ill, and we have no place to put them, no place to take care of them.
So when was the last time you were at Laguna Honda?
I was at Laguna Honda maybe 6 weeks ago. I have patients there who I visit, and they give me all the gossip.
What was it like for you to walk into a place that you had spent so much time in and that has, for most people probably know, has transformed itself?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
In the last few years. What was it like for you to go back?
Well, whenever I go back maybe every couple of months because I get a kick out of it and I like to visit my patients. And, well, it's completely different. I mean, visually it is just, it's just like completely different. It's just the citizens of San Francisco did a great job. It's beautiful. They've, you know, it's been, everything's been kept up, which is what we were all kind of concerned about. You know, it looks beautiful. It's much more, I think, of a, what would you call it, a siloed kind of place, in the sense that it's kind of ironic because the old place with those open wards and this whole flow and all the doors were open, the windows were open, and people flowed in and out, and it was kind of easy to flow around. I counted the last time I was, time before last, when I went to visit this particular patient who is very, very wonderful woman, very smart, has a, can't really get out. So she's pretty much bedridden. And I counted how many doors, locked doors, were between me and getting to see her. And it was like 12. Which means she has to get through 12 doors to get out. So that was the thing that was, I think a lot about, is this whole sense of the flow that was in that place, as opposed to, you know, these beautiful rooms and these long, shiny hallways and people in their different places on their computer doing their things. But I will say the patients are the same. And I think that the spirit that I talk about at the end of God's Hotel really did survive its transmogrification. It really managed to make it.
So tell us in the last 30 seconds or so, how are you approaching this new project, this new book you're working on?
Well, I'm doing two things because I really, at the same time, I'm working on this institute of, to get an institute of slow medicine going. So I'm doing that. I'm also, you know, talking a lot. And I've been working on this book quite assiduously. I would like to, I've realized that slow medicine needs more explication. People get it, but it's been fun to go like, really, what do I mean? If I say, what we have as a system now is the difference between healthcare and medicine is soul, right? It's like that's what got left out when we turned it into healthcare. What do I mean by that? And so that's kind of the question I'm looking at. And with using the patients that have affected me, not the ones in God's Hotel, to describe what I mean by what's missing from healthcare.
And so when can we expect the new book?
Well, I'm afraid to say because my editor would like to have it out, not 2016, but I expect it'll be out around April 2017.
Will you come back?
Oh, I'd love to.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank my guest this evening, Dr. Victoria Sweet, author of God's Hotel and associate clinical professor at UCSF and former physician at Laguna Honda Hospital. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's great.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. We'll be taking a couple of weeks off for the holidays. Join me again on Monday, January 11th, and check out our website to find out what will be in store. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night. Have a great week and happy holidays.